The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, listeners. Thanks for joining me on this very fine Saturday afternoon. It is March 29th, 2014. Vincent Renoir has, well, my sound is taking a while to come up again, but it's coming. It will do it. I'm quite sure. I'm just giving you the, I think it's because, on Thursday, I was talking with my, I was talking with my co-host, Ray Goodwin, before we started the program, and therefore the sound was good right from the start. Now, when I'm speaking by myself and I don't warm up my mic, it has something to do with the mic getting used to it, but it's okay now. So I'll say again, thanks for joining me. It's March 29th, 2014. But let me go on. I like this mic better than the other one I have because it has a better tone quality to it. So I'm trying to figure out how to use it. But when I have no guests that I talk to in advance of the show, that's what causes this problem usually. Vincent Renoir, who is a French revisionist, has just released a bilingual video. Finally, and on how the gas chamber story was treated at the Nuremberg Tribunal. I don't imagine it's a new video. Maybe it was already in French, already released at a previous time, but now they've added English subtitles. And I like that. I like the subtitles because we can still hear Vincent's voice speaking and while we read the subtitles and look at the very, very good images that are on it. And because the inflections in his voice give so much meaning. It is really excellent and it's only 8.5 minutes long, and which I like. I don't like to watch long videos, but it makes its point very well. So, I said that, which can be... It makes its point about the really the terrible process at the Nuremberg Tribunal, and that could be said to be the basis of my program today. And you can see this video on YouTube. It's called "The Gas Chambers of I'm not sure what it's called, but you can go very easily go to the video page at january27.org. where it's been uploaded. It's jan27.org, lowercase. That is simpler than looking for it on YouTube, actually. Just go there, scroll down the right side menu to where it says Select Videos, and click on that, and it will take you into that page. And Renoir's video is on the last of the four, is the last of the four on that page. You won't be sorry if you watch it if you have any interest at all in Holocaust revisionism. Now, Bill Fink has a new article about Ukraine, which I wanted to mention, because he has an alternative view to the prevailing cheerleading for Vladimir Putin. His contact in he has a contact in Ukraine who is a farmer from New Zealand, so he's English-speaking. Native English-speaking person. He married a Ukrainian woman and has been living in Ukraine with her for at least 12 years. This article can be found on the front page at christogenia.org. If you just scroll down just a little way, you'll see it. It's titled, Ukraine or Jukraine. And I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts from it. I think Bill is a good writer, and I don't have a clear point of view on this myself at the time, right now, as to because I think it all depends on how it turns out. If it turns out well, people will say, well, you know, we were right about supporting Putin. If it turns out badly, it'll say, they won't be able to say that. So, I'm kind of out on the, I'm holding my vote out for now. But Bill writes that, Ukraine is about 78% Ukrainian and 17% Russian. And the balance is made up mostly of, Tatars. I don't know exactly how you pronounce that, if it's Tatars or Tatars. While there are some, sometimes people put an R in there, which doesn't belong. Tartars, they want to call them, but this is something else. Or maybe it never was Tartars. But there's also some Poles, Romanians, and others in the various border areas. But those general numbers are deceiving, he says. The Russians and Tatars are concentrated along the eastern border, mostly in the Crimea, which is perhaps 65% Russian and practically 100% Russophile. Russians in the Crimea may consider themselves as natives now. However, most of them settled there during the Soviet era, when the region was an important asset to Soviet military interests, meaning the Soviet Union moved Russians into that area at that time. Somewhere a little further on in the article, another excerpt that I'm going to read, he writes, there are hundreds of Jewish oligarchs in Russia and Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin is their defender. Most of them have Israeli citizenship and travel freely back and forth to Israel from Eastern Europe. Putin meets with Chabad annually. That's the Chabad Lubavitcher group, you know, that is worldwide. And really among the worst, but in another way maybe not, because they make it very clear what they stand for, and they don't seem to be into too much deceit. So, but Putin has, I was reading about that elsewhere, and Putin has sort of picked them out as being his, the Jews he's going to most associate with, and they have a lot of access to him. And he had also made sure that this Museum of Tolerance and Holocaust type museum in Moscow that they built was either all paid for or partially paid for with funds, government funds. And he also personally donated to it. But, you know, they have to have that there in Moscow, like we have the one in Washington, D.C. Same type of thing. He's been supportive of that. And he's gone, of course, Bill says he's gone so far as to wear the yarmulke at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. Well, they all wear that. I don't know what that means, but they all do. You know, I guess they can't go there if they don't put that on their head, and they have to be seen there for the Jews to be satisfied. So it is another way of giving in to the Jews. At the same time, Bill writes, thousands of young Russian and Ukrainian women are lured to Israel each year with the promise of jobs. And when they get there, they are forced to work as sex slaves in the many hundreds of Jewish whorehouses in Palestine. The trade is well documented, and Putin has done nothing to stop it. At the same time, as many as 6 million illegal Asian immigrants have flooded into Moscow, and Putin has done nothing to stop that. Russian immigration laws are also quite amenable to aliens and have encouraged an influx of cheap labor into Russia, much like the Mexican immigrants who are flowing into America or the Turks and Africans into Europe. At every turn, Vladimir Putin's domestic policies are clearly anti-nationalist, Russian or otherwise. And the more that is, he's not a Russian nationalist or any other kind of nationalist, and the more one investigates, the more Putin looks like just another globalist Western politician. So that is from Bill Fink. And again, that's his article, Ukraine or Jewcrane, which you can read on his website, christogenia.org. There on the front page, Christogenia is spelled C-H-R-I-S-T-O-G-E-N-E-A. All right. Now, something connected to this, what I just read to you, is a news story that I found, I think just yesterday, or the day before, but in the Wall Street Journal, March 25th, 2014, page A9, titled EU, flight from Syria, Russia drives increase in asylum. So the EU saw a surge in asylum seekers, it tells us, in 2013, with Syria and Russia being the source of many of them. It's the Russian aspect here that interests me. The 28 EU countries had 435,000 asylum requests in 2013. That's all of the EU, up from 335,000 in 2012. So that's quite a big, that's a 100,000 increase. That's a one-fourth type increase. 25% type increase, I guess it would be. In 2013, Syrians were the largest group, making up 12%, or 52,200, followed by Russia, who sent out 41,000 into Europe, Afghans at 26,000, Serbs 22,000, Pakistanis 21,000, and Kosovans 20,000. The number of Somalis, Eritreans, Iranians, and Nigerians also rose. The number of Iraqis fell. Relative to its size, Sweden received the most asylum seekers, mainly Syrians. Without adjusting for population, though, all told, Germany received the most, followed by France, Sweden, United Kingdom, and Italy. So, you know, in this, Russia is mixed in with all these third world countries, where it's poor and unemployed are going into Western Europe, looking for work and looking for a better way of life. And I don't know what the ethnicity of these Russians is, whether they're white Russians or other kind of non-white Russians. But so much for the great job Russia is doing, in taking care of its people, because you don't find Western Europeans immigrate looking to move out of Western Europe like this and going into these other countries. Not at all. It's still a one-way flow that it's always been. All right, now another story I want to look at that I think is pretty darn interesting, not particularly connected with what I just read already, is from March 26th. I forget where it's from, but it's an international story. Margot Kassmann, the former head of the Protestant and Lutheran churches in Germany, has admitted that her church has been complicit in fostering anti-Semitism in Germany since the times of Martin Luther. Oh, my. So, you know, this is supposedly a German woman. Whether she's Jewish, how could she be Jewish? She's a big former head of the Lutheran churches, the Protestant and Lutheran churches in Germany. So she's not Jewish, you know. But she is... She's trying to stamp out any anti-Semitism in the Protestant church. She called Luther's 1543 1543 pamphlet that he wrote about the Jews and their lies horrible, and wrote in an opinion article in a German monthly, she said this: there was a strong anti-Jewish tendency present in Protestantism. Hence, there is a history of guilt. But we're going to be guilt is part of the subject matter today, as the topic of my show is about moral legitimacy and for whites. But here, these people are trying their best to keep attaching guilt to all of us because we don't love the Jews. And this one is no exception. She's currently serving as the church's special ambassador to mark the 500th anniversary of the posting of Martin Luther's 95 Theses, in which he disputed the Catholic Church doctrine and said the church had learned from past, Kassmann said that the Lutheran Church had, and Protestant Church in Germany, had learned from past mistakes, and today such anti-Semitism was unthinkable in the church. So here we have their founder, the great and renowned Martin Luther. And because he spoke, he finally discovered the Jewish problem and spoke out absolutely directly about it, with no doubt in anybody's mind, what he thought should happen with the Jews, and that the Jews should not be allowed anywhere near the church. She says, oh, well, they denounce their founder and this man who has this great reputation. And this is able to get by, you know, all these white Protestants are able to somehow work that out in their minds, that Martin Luther was the founder of their religion and did this great, fantastically courageous act of breaking away from the Catholic Church, the first one ever to do so, and in protest to the Catholic Church doctrines that had become somewhat pretty corrupt. But what he thought about Jews was just, he was just all wet, and he must have gone senile and lost his mind, and so it's unthinkable. Meanwhile, another person in Germany, a renowned German criminologist, Christian Pfeiffer, urged the Protestant Church to do more to deal with past anti-Semitism. He suggests a commission of historians to examine the impact of Luther's anti-Jewish teachings. Over the centuries, Luther's anti-Semitism had impacted the thinking of many people, and the Nazis had exploited that. Therefore, it was wrong that some church leaders put Martin Luther onto a pedestal to protect him from his legacy, from any criticism, said Pfeiffer. So this is somebody. He's a criminologist. I don't know. He's a Protestant. So he's speaking out that the Lutheran Protestant Church has to take Martin Luther off his pedestal and not protect him. Because they want to protect the Jews instead. This is a situation, I don't need to belabor that, this is the situation we're in. And we see it over and over again, you know, every week these little stories come up and this stuff. It gets so tiresome. But, so here we have why can't we get the better of this? Well, so we have the question of moral legitimacy for whites comes up. And this, of course, is that the whites have none. And even Martin Luther has no moral legitimacy in the area where he criticized Jews. So that's really what it boils down to. And Kevin McDonald has brought it up. And that's where I got the two words from to use, moral legitimacy. And it made a big impression on me. And he was talking about it in a radio interview he did recently. And he said something to the effect of, it's, just vitally important for white people to get a sense of moral legitimacy again. And I'm using the word regain, to regain our moral legitimacy. And it is. And it struck me that was the basic problem, the key problem, and that would be the key solution. But how to do this? You know, that this has been under discussion for quite a while, I would say, here and there amongst people. It all comes down to this: how do we get over these guilt trips and all of this stuff that we keep being put on, and we white people have come to accept the, not the awake whites, but the other whites in general in our culture has come to accept white guilt as a given. And don't argue with it. And this has been devastating for us. So I'm looking at my notes here and wondering how I get from there to the next spot. I'm talking about a book. What book? This book is an example that can be... Oh, I know. So I use this picture of the... in my program announcement... of this book that was issued in Third Reich Germany to the students when they graduated from basic school. Those who, from there you go on to the gymnasium, you go on to higher levels of high school, and or some didn't go and went on to take on a trade as, what do you call that, you know, journeyman or something. Not journeyman, the other, when you're learning the trade. Or, they go into the trades. So at this point, they gave out this little book to all the children, boys and girls. And it talked about, as I said, your family, your folk, what the Reich meant, the characteristics that you should strive to have and how you should put these things above all, always. And anyway, I've read portions of it. It's really nice. You know, when the National Socialist, these things were put out pretty much by the National Socialist Party, but not this one might not have been. They weren't all. Some were put out by the Ministry of the Hitler's government. So there's a variety there. But if they're in the schools, probably put out by the government ministry. But they had such a nice way of speaking to young people, to their young people, that I don't know, I don't think, I've never seen it like that anywhere. And it's because they had this sense that they were one, that they were united, and that they were speaking to their young people who respected them and respected their nation and were thinking in a sincere fashion, and they were speaking in a sincere fashion. I just don't see it as indoctrination at all. Not the way we think of indoctrination. It was because they covered a lot of things, and it was very honest, and it was very straightforward. Anyway, that kind of a book, you know, just shows the kind of culture we should have. If we had nations where we could be in control and we had our own people, we're speaking to our own people, we would be instilling in our youth a belief in ourselves it's just implied that we are good people, that our goals are acceptable, our goals are okay, we agree with our goals, we don't see ourselves as being bad, even if other peoples might want to portray us that way. We see ourselves as being an upright and righteous nation, and we're fighting for our national causes. You have to do that. See, we've come into this way of thinking of worrying about other people and what other people are going to think of us, and how we're treating other people. And all of our own people are the ones who are expected to sacrifice what is good for us in order to take, you know, to supply what is good for the other people. And if these people come into our country, that's the next thing that happens. Then they're allowed to come into our country, anybody's country, whatever group we're talking about, they're allowed to come into your country. And then they're allowed to become citizens and so on. And then you have to help them come up to the level that the native people are at, or that we are at, and that you are at. And if they don't, then it's seen as your fault. Well, we know that whole story. And you have to try harder and work harder. And all the problems that these peoples are having are because you... are not a nice enough person. You know, and if you get tired of it, as long as you're giving and giving, you're okay. But if you get tired of doing that and don't want to do it, well, then it's because you're a hateful person. And all of this, and this actually has taken hold. This has taken hold as the politically correct version of what is expected of people. And this is what has to be turned around. Now, how do you turn this around? Well, I would, for one thing, I just think that this lumping everyone together, lumping all whites together as one thing that's going to work together to fight off non-white invasion and also Jewish control of our cultures can never ever work. Now, and the other thing I should say is that it comes down to culture. You see, it's a cultural thing. What we've lost is our culture, our own culture. And what that little book, that the cover I put on the announcement to today's show is implying is that we love our own culture. Our culture is our culture, and we stand up for it, and we will defend it, and we think it's good, and we think we're good. But what has happened is that our culture has come under attack, and then at the same time, all white people don't have the same culture. If you're going to compare whites to other races, you can say, well, we have our culture, our white culture, and they have a Negro culture, African culture, or others have a Asian culture, and so on. And you can see very clear differences in the cultures in that way. But once you exclude the non-whites, then you look amongst all the whites, then you can see all the differences among the cultures of whites. Within the white group, and they're very clear and distinct. And if you try to if you want to blur those boundaries, then a whole lot is going to be lost, and people are not going to react well to it. So the first thing we have to do is recognize the different cultures among whites, And that amongst our peoples, as I've been saying, there are leaders and there are followers. You know, there are those who have a history of accomplishment and leadership, and those who do not have such a history. So it doesn't. It means that you have to see. We have this politically correct way of talking. But we can't say what we really think. We can't say what we think is true, because it's going to hurt people's feelings. And this is the same as the political correctness that we have under the Frankfurt School and the whole cultural Marxism, that it's become against the law to hurt people's feelings. And we've got the same kind of thing within our white nations. That if you distinguish in some way that is taken as insulting to another nation, one nation, then you can't do that. And it makes me think of Henry Ford's International Jew in one of the last two chapters that we read in that. One of them, I don't know which one, but it was pointed out that there was these three rules, they said, that in dealing with Jews, that the Jews had imposed. And one of them was, we know we do wrong things, we know we have bad Jews, but you should not talk about it. It was like a lot of things are acknowledged, are that you couldn't really deny them. And since they don't want to acknowledge them openly, they don't want the whites to, or the Americans in that case or whatever, to talk about them. you just don't speak about it. And that's what we've got in political correctness. You can think things. I mean, a lot of things are obvious for people to understand, but they can't be discussed openly. They can't be mentioned. They can't be spoken of. And this puts, well, we all know the images of the white man with his, you know, tape over his mouth and so on that are so popular, you know, where we can't speak. And even then amongst our own white folk, there are things that we're not supposed to say and we can't speak because these people, there are people in there who are, too sensitive about what is actually recognized, but they don't want to hear about it because they, just like with the Jews, or with the Negroes, so on, they want to have illusions. They want to live in a world of illusions, and they want to eventually win out over in the propaganda field, or just in the actually through political correctness by not allowing you to point out their failings. Because, it, you know, on the basis that it's going to hurt their, it hurts their feelings. So here we have, you know, I just find it very interesting that as we point to our enemies outside of the white race as playing these games, of political correctness and using political correctness, well, we have it going on within our own white, race of people. So I was just looking, I've just got some trivia here I'm going to go through. Like I thought to myself, because now I'm talking about the division between the Germanic, Western European ethnic group, and I include, I'm saying Germanic, but I also think in terms of just German, but in a sense it also should include Germanic, because as opposed to the Slavic, because the Slavic takes in a lot of different national groups too, you know. So it might, it's probably better to put it that way. But so I asked, how many U.S. presidents have been Slavic? Because I couldn't think of one, and so I looked it up and found that none have ever been. Of course, there's only ever been one German. So they're all of the U.S. presidents have been a mix of Englishmen, Welsh, Irish, Scots, Brits, and Scots-Irish. The Bush family is English. And so all the U.S., all our U.S. presidents have been members of the nations that make up the British Isles of some kind. You know, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? There was one Dutch, that's the or a couple, that's the Roosevelts and somebody else, and one German who is, guess who, Eisenhower. The man who said how much he hated Germans during the war. So I don't know what kind of German he was. Some people think he was a Jew, so or part Jewish. He couldn't be all Jewish, but he comes from a German background. Now, very often the Slavs do not rule over their own people, obviously because they're not the best rulers. The Lithuanians have often been the rulers over the Poles. They get kind of mixed in together there. But Pilsudski, one of the greatest Polish heroes that the Poles like to hold up, was a racial or ethnic Lithuanian rather than a Pole, although he was supposedly Polonized by living in Poland, and I think maybe even had been born in Poland from his Lithuanian parents. But there was a lot of overlap there in where these people lived, the Lithuanians and the Poles. And the Lithuanians are closest to the Latvians, Estonians, and Finnish, none of which are Slavic. And these people are supposed to be above average height. I mentioned, because I'm getting at here, if we're going to be a strong white race of people, if we're going to save the white race and all these slogans that people are saying, who is going to be leading this? You know, who, and also I want to get at, maybe I should say this right now, is that after the Hitler Table Talk program this past Thursday, Ray Goodwin said to me, we were chatting just a little bit, and he said, there always has to be an elite. Well, I found it interesting that he said that. Thinking about it, it's true. I think in order to, there has to be an elite who is in charge and that is going to lead, and the rest need to basically, not that you can't question it, but you know, have to go along, because you have to have a leadership group to get anything done. And that you have to pick the best people. Who is your best leadership group? Who should be the elite? So I want to talk about leadership of European nations for a while. Not that, these are the royal families, and not that the royal families represent the people. The fact is they didn't, you see. They tended to be always Western Europeans. Catherine the Great of Russia, who is considered after Peter the Great to be one of the, you know, maybe the greatest monarch that they had, was a full German. And I said this on a program recently, but I'll give now the only son of Catherine and her husband Peter, who was not Peter the Great, was Paul, who reigned for 5 years after the death of his mother. So I don't know that Peter was 100% German. I don't know what Peter was. I didn't get that checked out. But so Paul would be at least half German, probably more, a little more. Paul had two wives, and they were both German. And there are some children from either both of them or just the second one. But they were named Alexander and Constantine. So now they were majority German, because he was already half German, and then his second wife was full German. I mean, his two wives were both full German. So their children would be now at least three-quarter German. Then the childless Alex the First ruled. That was that Alex that was Paul's son. For some reason, he didn't have children. Then he didn't rule for a very long time, but he was followed by his younger brother, Nicholas. Nicholas the First. Now, was that Constantine, who then they named Nicholas? I don't know. But he ruled, Nicholas the First ruled for 30 years. He's a major ruler of Russia from 1825 to 1855. And his wife was another German, Charlotte of Prussia. So there you're watering it down even more. They had seven children. And their first son was Alexander the Second. I believe this is right. And he succeeded his father, Nicholas the First. And his wife, he married a German too, Marie of Hesse and by Rhine, it's called. Marie of Hesse and by Rhine. Now, this is why it's said that the Germans were ran Russia. All these years during the empire, before the Bolshevik Revolution. And Alexander II was succeeded by his son, Alexander III, who married Dagmar of Denmark. So there's more, you know, another Germanic. And now all this is taking away from any Russianness of this royal family. And the firstborn of Nicholas II, was the last emperor. No, the firstborn of, I read that wrong, the firstborn of this marriage of Alexander III and Dagmar of Denmark was Nicholas II, who was the last emperor. And I would have to say he's by now pretty much totally German. And he married another Prussian, Alex of Hesse. And she was the one who, the queen, the empress, that they had their five children. They were the ones who were murdered by those hideous Bolsheviks. Now, Nicholas, okay, I've got that. And then in addition to that, I understand, and I've read, although I didn't look into it real deeply, but that the Russian bureaucracy, the bureaucrats who are necessary to any government, who are, you know, keeping things going, running things, and heading all of these ministries and so on, and were made up of Germans and Prussians too, imported, probably brought in, I don't know how, because we know there are a lot of times Germans, even the farmer types, were asked to come and settle in Russian territory because they help improve the farming and so on, and help build up certain areas. So there are a lot of Germans at the top level of Russian society and of the, especially in government. So now here's some more trivia about various royalty in Europe. Now, I kind of passed over it real fast, but it's Nicholas II, who is the one that we're all most familiar with as the last Tsar. His mother, which I mentioned, his mother was Maria Fyodorovna. They gave her that name, but she had been born Alex of Hesse on June 6, 1872 in Darmstadt, Germany. She was a granddaughter of Queen Victoria of the United Kingdom, and Alex was baptized in 1872 according to the rites of the Lutheran Church and given the names of her mother and each of her mother's four sisters. And her godparents were the Prince and Princess of Wales, the Russian Tsarevich and Tsarevna, the Princess Beatrice of the United Kingdom, the Duchess of Cambridge, and Princess Anna of Prussia. So, you know, it's known. I mean, I'm not revealing anything people don't know, but that these royal families of Europe are all intermixed. And I realize now that they had to do that so that they wouldn't deteriorate they had to marry another person of royal heritage. So they would be marrying within their own royal group all the time if they didn't marry outside of it. So they had to find royal families or aristocratic families and so on in other nations in order to make, you know, unions where they would have good progeny and they wouldn't, interbreed, you know, and like they did in Spain, like that royal family did in Spain when they had all those feeble-minded kings and queens and princesses and so on. So, so this is why this was going on. And where did they go to find these mates? Where did the Russians go? They went to Germany, Prussia, mostly Prussia, but, you know, and Prussia was pretty large at that time, and to the United Kingdom, mostly. But it seems like these Russians liked the Prussians best. That's where they got most. But they are related to, because the Prussians and the Germans also married into the British aristocracy and royal families and so on. So there they all got interrelated with one another. And this goes on to say about Nicholas II's mother. Her family gave her the nickname of Aleki in order to distinguish her from her aunt, the Princess of Wales, who had the family nickname of Alex. And she was actually called Alex, too, but they had to give her a different little nickname to distinguish. And they also called her Sonny, which later Nicholas called her also. And Alex and her surviving siblings grew close to their British cousins, spending holidays with Queen Victoria. With her sister, Princess Irene, Alex was a bridesmaid at the 1885 wedding of her godmother and maternal aunt, Princess Beatrice, to Prince Henry of Battenberg. Now, where does Princess Beatrice come from? That sounds like the Dutch or the Netherlands. Is that one of the names they use? But, and I don't know about Battenberg, and that sounds, you know, it's got Berg on it, but it sounds kind of English. So, anyway, I didn't have time to check into every detail. So then, now Nicholas was the eldest son of Emperor Alexander III, whose wife was the Princess Dagmar of Denmark. I already said that. This is just kind of a going over some of this. His paternal grandparents were Emperor Alexander III and Empress Maria Alexandrovna of Russia, who was born Princess Marie of Hesse-Darmstadt, another German. You know, they give him Russian names, but they come from Germany. His maternal grandparents, Nicholas's, were King Christian on his maternal side, that is, his German mother's side, were King Christian IX and Queen Louise of Denmark. And Nicholas was actually a primarily, so I'm saying Nicholas was actually a primarily, no, they said Nicholas was actually a primarily German descent, as well as Russian, Danish, and French descent. So there you are. Then I went back to the beginning, kind of, and I looked at different royal families and their houses. King Albert I of Belgium married Elizabeth, Duchess of Bavaria. So they married into a German family. Their son was Leopold III. So then Leopold III got on the throne of Belgium, and he was the one reigning through World War II, all the way through World War II and after. And his wife was a Swedish princess, Astrid. And one of their children became the present King Albert II. Albert II married Donna Paola di Principi Rufo di Calabria, and she's got more names than that, but who I take as Italian. And they had a son, and he married a Belgian commoner in 1999, who was made a princess by, you know, at the time of their marriage. They turned her into a princess. But so there you have the Belgians, you know, marrying out, and you have the royal family of Albania. Now they had King Zog the first. That's a short line in Albania, but the first one they listed was King Zog the first. I like that name. He married a Hungarian countess in 1938. So that's, like I say, kind of new. I don't know. Their son was named Luka, and L-E-K-A, Leka. He married an English woman from Australia in 1975, and their child was born in 1982, also named Prince Leka. That's not very much of a royal family, but the royal family of Bulgaria started with King Ferdinand, and there was a few Ferdinands, and he married an Italian princess in 1893. She did have at least one child, but she died in childbirth then, and he married a German princess, Eleonora Caroline, in 1908. And then the Bulgarian royalty went on to marry more Germans and Italians. And then when the last one was in exile, he married, they started marrying Spanish named women. So by now they are not very Bulgarian either, if they ever were. Not that there's a royal family in Bulgaria anymore, but that's the way it goes. So Adolf Hitler wanted to create a new elite of Germans. Back to what Ray said, and using that terminology, and I think it's absolutely proper from what we're reading in Table Talk, that his idea for Europe was that there would be an elite of Germans and eventually Germanics based on competence, intelligence, and the highest qualities of character, as we know, were considered in the National Socialist Party and government to rule over and manage a great Reich of the Northern Germanic countries in cooperation with Great Britain, too, and its dominions. If possible, he wanted to be in cooperation with Great Britain. If he wanted that, never. It never happened, but that was his idea of perfection, and would expand far into the east, all the way to the Urals. And he never foresaw that it would be ruled by the Slavs, as the Slavs had never yet, I'm saying this, as far as I can tell, ever succeeded in rule. They never really succeeded as rulers. People can get upset about this, but this is, to me, seems like the facts. And if we think in terms of how we're going to get ourselves together again, I think we have to turn to the best people, the best people. And it doesn't mean that every part of the best people has to be German. But I'm saying that the history of Europeans, and we are all Europeans or consider ourselves Europeans, is that the Germanic races, if you want to call them races, I will call them races. Somebody might object to that. Put that in parentheses, I mean in quotes or something. The Germanic peoples have been the leaders. And a lot of people then will say, well, these leaders did us in, they did this bad thing to us and that bad thing to us. But if you allow the non-leadership portion to take control, how can I say that in a nice way? I can't. But, blood-curdling murderers, you know. I mean, they are vicious and uncivilized and radically revolutionary and so on. So it's not, I think, you know, history shows us this. In every Slavic nation, there has been some kind of a noble leader that has arisen and has tried to start something good. You know, a lot of it took place in the 20s, 30s, and even into the 40s, in alliance with these new ideas that came, that Adolf Hitler personified, and certain people in Britain and elsewhere, Italy and other countries. And these were good people. And I think that these nations, these people do better when they align themselves with what the Germanic nations are thinking about and are doing, and then fall into line with that. I think that has been our very best examples of our people. And if we and if that had been able to succeed, if what Adolf Hitler was trying to do had been able to succeed, then how much better it would have been for everyone all along the line. Now in the, where should I go with this? Maybe I'll go back to this book. So what the Germans were teaching themselves, in this, okay, I'm going to go here. In this, in these, like a little book like this, was these, noble qualities of character and behavior and thinking, where you, admired and, respected your leaders, your leadership, because it was worthy of respect. And you could do so. Now, nowadays we're all so used to thinking of our Western European leadership and Anglo-American leadership is so horrible. Of course it is, but it didn't ever have to be. And it wasn't always, but, particularly I think there's no better example for us than the National Socialist period. I'm sorry. See, and so I'm going to close off this first hour by going back to Kevin MacDonald. And I I really appreciate the ideas that he puts out there, and I got this idea about moral legitimacy. I think he's right on about that. I think he's one of the best people, if not the best person we have speaking for us. He just happens to think that he thinks of National Socialism in terms of Nazis and show-off kind of Nazis, you know, skinheads and tattooed people and people running around waving swastika flags where it's not really appropriate. And then he thinks in terms of how the American people are totally brainwashed about the war and about Hitler and National Socialism and so on. It's too much to get over. We won't get over it. So, we shouldn't be, we should just leave that, let that go and not bring that up. And you know, I understand where he's coming from. Of course, I think we should forego a lot of these kinds of Nazi groups, you know, that call themselves Nazis today. But at the same time, every time I try to think of how to go forward, this vilification of National Socialist Germany seems to me to be the very thing that prevents it, because it's always being pointed to as why we have done all these bad things and why loving your race is a bad thing, loving your white race is bad. It all points back to that. So I don't see how we can ignore it. And I would think a head-on, direct, we would just deal with it in a more direct fashion and try to change people's images of this. So anyway, we're going to the break, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy the music, and I will be back with you to carry on with this in 5 minutes.
Down in the valley so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow, dear, hear the wind blow, hang your head over. Don't love me, love whom you please. Throw your arms round me, give my heart ease. Give my heart ease, dear, give my heart ease. Throw your arms round me. Give my heart ease. Roses love sunshine, violets love dew, angels in heaven know I love you, know I love you.
For a long time, my
words you never would say. Now at last all my fond hopes have vanished for the sake that you're going away. How about a mandolin solo? This is the verse that that makes me think I kind of know why the guy's going away. Because she is whining. Do you think of the valley you're leaving? Oh, how lonely, how drear it will be. Do you think of the kind heart you're breaking? And the pain that you're causing to me. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true.
Take it, friend.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You know that those, I never got the right word for those two pieces of music. They should be called ballads. They're ballads from actually early American times. They go back that far. And they're just generally nice little songs. And so ballads used to be so popular at one time and at that time, I suppose. So, I'm Carolyn Yeager, and this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on March 29th. I'm going to take phone calls in this hour if anybody wants to chime in on the things I've been talking about or challenge anything I've said. The number is 1-830-443-4911. You're welcome to call, but I would like to take a few minutes here to speak about something. I was talking about Kevin McDonald right before the break, and in talking about our moral legitimacy, I heard Kevin McDonald saying that we are, we're a good people, and we should say so. And he said people like point to slavery, but he says we freed the slaves. You know, he said we're the first peoples to free slaves, and everybody else had slavery. So what, then he said, we'll say things like about World War II, and all the criticism. Well, we fought to liberate, the Jews from the concentration camps and so on. And so that was a real thing. See, now that's exactly the kind of moral legitimacy, that I don't think we should, rely on. I think we shouldn't be trying to talk about how good we are in the same way of thinking as the politically correct non-whites think good should be. We should not fall for that. We don't have to be good in their idea what good is, according to their idea what good is. We need to make it very clear what we think is good and then stand by that no matter if they criticize us. See, this seeking for approval from those who don't really want to approve of us is not the right idea. And even within the white community of nations, or the community of white nations, if some white nations think in order to be good, you need to do things that are going to be more beneficial to them as their distinct group, well, you know, that shouldn't be the what we shouldn't fall for that either, because what is has it has to be what's good for all whites and for all of us to live a better and better life and to become better and better people for ourselves and our own people, not to serve all the non-whites in the world. That we should never fall for that. So, well, that's just one of my ideas that comes to me pretty strongly. If anybody wants to, you know, speak about that or go against that or something, that's fine. Again, the number is 830-443-4911. So, I want to go on and talk about, well, there's so many things I could talk about. But this book, I've got some information here. Always going to talk about corruption, a little bit. One thing that Hitler said in the table talk we read on Thursday was he was talking about how incorrupt the German bureaucracy was during his time then. This was 1941. And it really was pretty incorruptible at that time. Whereas we find always, as we look at levels of corruption as judged by these international, you know, organizations that are not don't have prejudice one way or the other, we find that Europe, Western Europe, and the Nordic countries and the United States and Canada more than the United States nowadays have the least amount of corruption, and of course Africa and some other place, different areas of the world have the most, but Slavic nations have a pretty bad level, not the worst, but a pretty bad level of corruption. So that says a lot about the moral development, if you will, or not so much that, because the people who tolerate corruption, like say Mexicans, I've lived in Mexico, that's a problem in Mexico, but it doesn't mean that all these people, they're not all these good people there and honest people and beautiful people, really. Who would always give you a hand and always help you out and be honest with you. And, they're very religious Christians, go to church and so on. So it's not that there aren't, all these people there, but what is it? It's something about it's their feeling, their national feeling. See, one thing you learn when you live in Mexico is that one of the very different cultural, very striking, is that they are tribal. They're family tribal oriented. They think in terms of their extended family as being what they care about. And every family does this. And the whole community, the community as a whole, is not seen as something that they should care about the way we do, say, in the United States, because we're, you know, from white people, from from Europe and so on. We all have that sense of we are one nation and we all, you know, work together to make it good for everybody, for all of us, not everybody in the world, but for all of us. You know, we don't throw garbage in the street. We don't, you know, we don't do any of these things. We try to keep everything clean and nice, and we take care of the roads and we take care of things for everyone. That's our cultural heritage. But these people who allow corruption have less of that. They don't respect their national leaders, really. They don't care about their community that much. They have walled in homes, and you'd be surprised about how nice these places are when you go inside their wall. And they have their gardens and so on. They keep that all very nice and clean. But what's out in the street is just a place to put your garbage out there. And sometimes you just throw it around. So that's that I think is why they tolerate corruption, because they don't have that sense of the larger community and the importance of the larger community. And it, you don't get that either. You can't just teach people that, because that easily. People are some of these people are in the United States for a long time before they start to, some of that starts to rub off on them. So in this book, You and Your Folk, which is could be the answer to how to regain our moral legitimacy, which is, of course, we have to instill it in our youth. To instill it in our youth, we have to have charge of education, and to have charge of education, we have to have charge of we have to have power in the in our nation, or in our community, in our society. That's all depends on that. But they are promoting the ideals of courage, bravery, honesty, and loyalty. These are beautiful things. But if you're so cynical, and you think your whole country is full of, run by crooks, which ours are pretty much, then why would you, you know, who would you show this for? Why would you develop this in the way that that they're encouraging in this book in Germany? And you have a love of your own people and a sense of the rightness. I think I kind of went over this earlier, but the rightness of your people and respect for your parents and your ancestors and your leaders. Because, as I say, you know, they're all deserving of respect. They're not the kind of people that that we find in degenerate or more degenerate societies. Then you have love of one's land and homeland. There's unabashed love of your land at that time and your homeland. The land itself you love, and you're going to defend it. You believe that it rightly belongs to you and your folk. It's yours, and you must keep it for the future, for your progeny, and defend it. And of course, there's also encouraged a healthy lifestyle, free of bad habits, which is not, say, look at just the United States of America, how this, once in a while you see little articles about it, but it's really not encouraged, because nobody makes money off of that. So everything that's encouraged in actual fact are things that make money for oligarchs, and so all of these things are allowed. And this book, I'm sure they discourage smoking. Drinking is frowned upon, not forbidden, but you know, it's not good to, older men always, the men always drank, but for the youth, you're supposed to not drink. And sex was generally considered to be kept for marriage, for both boys and girls and men and women, and for creating a family. And you had, in creating a family was always put as something that you were expected to do. It was your duty. It was your part of your job as a member of this of your nation to have a decent sized family. Therefore, you know, you stayed married to the same woman, and there was a protective attitude toward women folk, not this anger and hatred toward women, but it was not suffocatingly protective, because you know, women were seen as people who could handle things and do things and could be independent if they wanted to be. So these are things that we need for our moral legitimacy, is to think highly of ourselves and not doubt ourselves, and to be for us. This is all pretty obvious. But so I'm going to go to some material on the what is so often vilified about National Socialist Germany is the racial eugenics, and not the the racial policy and the general eugenic policies and the Lebensborn program. can be included in that also is usually exaggerated in a bad way. I'm going to go first to this high school bioethics curriculum project. It's if you have love for yourself and your people, you then want to be the best. And somehow when it's natural and used to be quite acceptable for people to use certain to encourage practices that would make them have the healthiest and most intelligent progeny and so on, and to think forward in a forward way about your nation. But that has all gotten destroyed by the propaganda, post-1945 propaganda, for the most part, I would say it was. And so whenever we read anything about National Socialist Germany, we get all this negative stuff about how everything that they did led to the Holocaust. And the Holocaust isn't even real, but it's, you know, believed to be. So everything they did led to this mass murder of Jews. That is such a shameful thing. It never happened anything like that before in the history of the world, and these Germans did it, and therefore they can never be trusted, and we can't carry on with any of the things that they espoused or took part in. It all has to be rejected. So there's this thing I found looking up Nazi racial policy. And to get away from Wikipedia and what they say, and I was reading some of that this morning, and God, it's, you know, it's just so bad. It just, half the stuff they have on there is unsourced. So you can't, you know, it doesn't even have it's not even authentic. But this thing started out pretty good. It's actually just a school program online that, you know, about bioethics that you can follow, and it's got questions and stuff at the end of each chapter and so on. But this one started out pretty good, and then it went bad. But this is chapter 5, the Nazi eugenics programs. And they say correctly, start out, the economy of Germany was in shambles at the end of World War I. The population was decimated. The government, this was the Weimar Republic, which was in power from 1919 until 1933, looked to popular eugenic theories for ways to restore and improve the health and physical well-being of the populace. You know, I need to move this page over so I can see if I get a call from anybody. Well, this is kind of hard because they're moving together. Wonder why. Well, they are moving together. Okay. Anyway, I checked. I didn't have a call. So it says in 1932... inspired in part by Laughlin's model eugenics law and other writings in the United States, the Weimar government drafted a plan for sterilization of individuals with hereditary illnesses. Many people were living in institutions, and they were costly to the country. Sterilizing them would prevent them from having children. Some might then also be able to leave the institution and live on their own. The plan involved those to be sterilized or their guardians in decision-making requiring prior consent to the procedure. This was in the Weimar Republic still, 1932, with the National Socialists breathing down their neck and, you know, getting stronger and stronger. So maybe that's why they decided to do a little bit of this. But when the National Socialists took over in 33, in July 1933, the new government issued its law for the prevention of progeny with hereditary diseases. Anyway, they admitted up here, they admitted earlier that Germany had many people living in institutions. And they They weren't even sterilized. So they thought if they sterilized them, some of them could maybe go and live on their own. But they were living in institutions because they had to be looked at. They had to be kept from, maybe partly from going around and having sex. That might have been part of it. They didn't have enough sense not to. This law was more directive, and it was people with so-called hereditary illnesses had to be sterilized under this law, even if they objected. But we do know that there was a court which they could go to, and that court often, if they presented their case well, that court often allowed them to be released from this law. And the number of the list of hereditarily ill diseases included congenital feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia. Well, see, we have medicine now for that, but they didn't have that then. Manic depression, they didn't have that then, medicine for that. But wouldn't it be nice to just get those genes out of the gene pool altogether so you wouldn't have to be treating all these people for all their illnesses? I think it would be. Hereditary epilepsy, Huntington's chorea, Huntington's disease, I guess, hereditary blindness, hereditary deafness, and serious physical deformities. Serious physical deformities, and also chronic alcoholism. It was also possible to sterilize those people. Now, we're just talking about sterilization, and I don't see why people with these kinds of genetic illnesses, which are passed on, hereditary, should be having progeny and passing it on to more and more people. I just don't see why that makes any sense. So here we're thinking in terms of it always comes down to the individuals or a certain select group of individuals or an individual versus the common, the whole group, the whole folk, the common good. That's what it comes down to. And it's a philosophical argument as to where you want to go with that. I'm going to go back to some of my earlier notes here because I do have some other material which I think is more important than going over this. This was kind of here for a emergency. And that is, there's this really amazing article that appeared on March 24th in which Vienna, this we're talking now, you know, back to the rise of the white nationalist parties or nationalist parties in Europe. The one in Austria, the Freedom Party, FPÖ, is doing very good, very well. And they are supposedly, here's a call, undisclosed. I wonder if this is, I don't take undisclosed. This might be, but I can hang up real easily, so I'll answer it. Because it might be, I did answer it. It might be Bob from D.C. Hi, caller.
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, hi, Carolyn. This is Marcus from Germany.
Oh, hi, Marcus. Okay. Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. A great show so far. And go ahead. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's this Germanic, Slavic, Slavic, Romanic dynamics. It's a real struggle for us. And there's political correctness in this as well. And I would like to point out that it's not only the Slavics against the Germans. I mean, I hear a criticism of Germans a lot from Serbs and from Russians and from Poles, but not so much from Croatians, for example.
Right, you exactly know? Right.
And what would be National Socialism without Maria Ortiz, for example. She was a Croatian, and she was, some say she was like a medium or something. Maybe she was just a philosopher, I don't know. But she had a big impact in the Thule society. And, you know, I never heard any Croatian make a big deal out of this, German supremacy or whatever you want to call it. It's just the way it is, you know. You go to Germany or Anglo-Saxon countries, and most of the time they're in charge. It's just natural. So what?
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you say? Did you say the Thule Society or some other society that this woman?
Yeah, Thule Society.
Thule. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, the Thule, you might like that. I'm not one that likes to promote the Thule Society because I don't think it was National Socialism did not embrace that at all. And it was a kind of a forerunner, and some people were involved in it for a while. But it was a bit too, I don't know. It was a bit too occult in a way, or it's presented that way.
Yeah, it's you can argue that, and there's pro and cons involved in that. You know, I heard people say all the bad things in the world about the Thule Society, and I heard people say it's the basis of National Socialism. So, I don't know, pick your side. Yeah.
I don't think it is. But anyway, that's okay. It's not bad or anything. That brings up something I was kind of wanting to put out on this program, but I was a little hesitant to how to get started on it. And this is a comment at the Daily Stormer from the program that Andre Anglin and I did. I guess that was just last Monday. And there's a zillion comments there. But this is a recent one from today that is from someone named Vita. Now here's typical kind of what I consider disjointed thinking from some of these people. Now she's supporting Russians, and I don't know if she is Russian. She says, she writes, question for Carolyn. Do you know that theory of Aryan movement, 1891, was written by inferior Russian occultist Helena Blavatsky? You know, she's the leader of the, what was that Blavatsky movement called? It's not actually on here. I can't think of it. I didn't even think that I should say it, but everybody should know who Helena Blavatsky is. She was a Russian, and I read some of her stuff way back when, and some of the other people from that group. Pretty useless, I finally decided. Vita goes on, even your Führer, not my, God forbid. So obviously he's not her leader. Borrow everything from her. The Führer borrows everything from Helena Blavatsky. You wouldn't even know that you are Aryan, she tells me, if it wasn't for another splendid, luminous, magnificent, inferior Russian. Inferior being sarcastic, I guess. And I don't know, she doesn't name someone, so maybe she's referring back to Helena Blavatsky again. So she says, I am responsibly repeating. Hitler took Helena's Aryan teaching and perverted it. So much about your integrity, Carolyn. Well, you see, I mean, that's just laughable to me. And what do you do with people like that? I think she's female.
We just have to recognize that some white people do things better than others. I mean, the Russian ballet, for example, I mean, who can beat that? I don't think any beat group could beat that. It's just too bulky in general, you know. So it's good and bad on every side, and we just have to recognize that. I'm just saying, and that's what you were saying, that this building and apparatus and administration, that's just a German thing. Fucked up. You know, just rely on it.
Yeah, it is a German thing, but I wouldn't go so far. Marcus, I can't go so far as to say, well, the Germans were good builders and administrators, but that's about it. And then these other people were good this and good that. No question that the Bolshoi Ballet, was supreme in the world, but they put a lot of effort into it. They put a lot of work into it. I don't know if Russians are better ballet dancers than other people naturally, or they just put more, you know, they built it up more. But they obviously have talent for it. I would think Asians would be better ballet dancers, but then they're not into ballet, so.
And they don't have this melancholic spirit. It doesn't look good. You can also see that when Japanese, for example, or Chinese, when they imitate, when they play these classic songs, you know, like who was this? Beethoven, this Heute schöner Götterfunken, you know, I saw that on the internet, and there were like 10,000 Chinese, and they were singing this, and they were doing a good job, you know, but it had no feeling. It's just lacking in them.
Marcus, are you outdoors somewhere?
Yeah, I'm in the car.
Because you're breaking up a little bit. I thought maybe you could change your location because you're breaking up quite a bit, so it might be that your internet connection is not so good.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Are you driving while you're talking?
Yes.
Oh. Well,
I can call in another time. I just wanted to make the point that I made.
Well, it was a good point. I appreciate that you did. Okay, I'll take that and go with it a little bit further since you called in and made this point. All right. Thanks for calling.
All right, thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, I would have liked to talk to Marcus longer, but that was really not very easy to hear him. So it's best we close that off. So there I got, at least I got that comment from Vita on there. Here's where we get, see, if you say that somebody is the best, or, you know, should is the best people to run things or so on, and has, and really, you can't, except for Russia, you can't compare, you can't compare any Slavic nations with the kind of, achievements that Germans have accomplished in all areas. So, you know, it's just that kind of a nation. Even if you compare with Germanic nations, they haven't come up nearly with what Germany has done. Not anything close. However, they're all a Germanic type people, and what they do have in common is that they have good, clean, honest administration and government. Societies, you know, the way, what expectations of how society is going to run. They all share that. So that maybe is the pinnacle, but the Germans also have all these great, philosophers, musical composers, fiction writers, and artists, visual artists and sculptors. Germany is a top-notch people, and it's just true. So if you somebody else wants to call in, please do, or wants to have a different point of view, you're very welcome to do so, and that gives me something to talk off you about. But let me, while I'm at it, go through. I'll just read a little more from this Vita. She wrote another comment. I just have to get this out of my system here, I guess. She wrote on March yesterday. She says she's a Serb now. She's a Serb. She says, this is another Serb who want to say something apropos all of this. First and foremost, Germans who claim that Germans are superior than anybody else have to prove that somehow. Problem is that there is no proof. I mean, Germany right now does not have sovereign state, does not have morals, does not have unity of people. Is this result of your superiority? No, thank you very much. Germany is obliged to import immigrants so Germans' pension plan and industry could function. Superior. I also believe that I am gorgeous and beautiful, but, and now she's being a little sarcastic there again, saying that you can't just say something to make it true. That's very true. And this Carolyn woman is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, for she speaks from her emotions, completely omitting history and facts. Well, I don't think that I omit history and facts. I'm complaining to the other people on that, on those comments there, and there is over 200 now, really tiresome, but that they are omitting history and facts. But anyway, she goes on, all through modern history, Germans always tried to conquer Slavic lands, but without success. Now, how much facts in history is in that? I guess for her, modern history is World War I and World War II, and Germany was only trying to conquer. Each and every time they were obliged to go home without gaining any. Just this fact is enough for a reasonable human being to stop waffling about superiority. Well, it wasn't the Slavs who defeated the Germans. It was the United States and the, you know, the Anglo-American alliance, but basically the United States that came in on with Russia and supplied them with all of that and then fought on two fronts. So that's what did it. So superior, she says, just watch inferior Slavs taking off, taking all of Europe in the next, she means to say, decades. It has already started and process is irreversible. Peace to you all, she ends. All right, so now she's buying into all this talk about how now Russia has taken control and is going to show Europe a thing or two and is going to show Obama a thing or two and is going to show NATO a thing or two and everything is going to change. It's all going to be the pan-Slavic nationalism is coming to the fore again. In her mind. So she might not be a young girl. She might be an older woman even because she says she's not gorgeous and beautiful. But so she may know a thing or two. She may, you know, have quite a bit of memory there about what's taken place. And this is what this talk that, you know, like of Andres and so on leads to. Everybody's getting all excited that they know the future already. And I just want to, I'll just point out here too that this is a pan-Slavic dream that's still alive in the hearts of people like Vita, obviously, that, there's going to be this big, strong pan-Slavism that's going to dominate in the, what you might say in greater Europe. But it never happened, and I don't think it ever will, but there we are. We're now at this east-west kind of competition and divide taking place based on the Ukrainian situation, I guess. I'm not going to say anything more about that. That's enough. Anybody wants to call about that, you're welcome to do so. Now, there is, I started talking about this two, there's three or four things yet, that this, article from Vienna and that the, Austrian, right, what they call the far right party that's been around for a long time. There used to be two, now there's just one, the Freedom Party, FPO. And actually FPO, and the elections are coming up in May, the European Union elections, and this party is running neck and neck with the two governing parties, with the two main parties, which is never, I guess, I don't know if it's ever done that well before. In the past it had done well and then got attacked And even the leader of the other party that did so well for a while was even died in a car crash, which I'm not saying was murder. Probably wasn't, but could be. Anyway, so now there's this candidate in the Austria's far-right party, Andreas Mölzer, who is now in the headlines and being attacked by the Austrian Jewish leader, Oskar Deutsch, who is, these Jews, they set themselves up in these organizations. And they think they're like, they think that they represent the Jews that are there, which is not that many. But they think that they are a major, major voice, and they get treated like it in the media. So what this Mölzer did was he said in some talk he was having somewhere that the Third Reich did not have as many rules and regulations, commandments and bans as the European Union. And this, now that's not okay to say. You see, we're talking about political correctness. Even though he's not making the Third Reich, saying positive things about the Third Reich, he's saying that it was a dictatorship, but it's not okay to say that the EU, which is the rule, in command now, in control, is worse than the Third Reich. That's not okay. And by saying that, this, Jewish leader says such people as this Mölzer may not represent Austria in Europe. They may not, he says. This is, they give out these commandments, he should, withdraw his candidacy. He needs to because of what he said. let's see what else here. I guess I've said everything that's important to say. So Mölzer, though, did not immediately respond to an email or to phone calls. So he hasn't said anything, but hopefully he won't retract anything. then there's this Rafael Madoff, and I'd like to show a picture of him, because if you ever thought in terms of a rat-faced Jew, he is a rat-faced Jew. I'll put the link to the article on the program page, and you'll be able to go and look at this man's face. It's really something. He does make you think of a rat. So he wrote, there's this on the JewishNewsService.org. They have this article about the U.S. ambassador to National Socialist Germany, and that he was anti-Semitic. And, going back in the 1930s to, what's his first name? Dodd, Ambassador Dodd, the American, ambassador from the United States to Germany, beginning with Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. So Franklin Roosevelt appointed him, and right at the time that Hitler, in June 1933, so 4 months after Hitler was chancellor, and he remained the U.S. And the approach at that time was to be friendly, to work with the new government and so on. I mean, Hitler was not seen then as the evil person that they've turned him into now. And there was a lot of natural and long-standing prejudice against Jews at that time that a lot of people had and it wasn't looked upon as it is looked upon today as so bad, although you wouldn't, if you're an ambassador, you wouldn't speak about it, but you wouldn't say it in words. But, this Dodd is someone that, there's a lot that we've learned about him. There's a lot about him, and he took part, he testified, I think, or took part in the prosecution or something of the, in the Nuremberg trials. But, in early 1934, he was being the National Socialist government was complaining to him about these mock trials of Hitler held at Madison Square Garden, where they did the one at Madison Square Garden, but then they were going to do another second one in Chicago. And the German government was very unhappy about this and was talking to the U.S. ambassador about it, telling him he should do something about this. This was a disgrace, allowing this. And, of course, these mock trials were put on by the American Jewish Congress and co-sponsored by their Jewish labor groups and Jewish civil rights groups. So, and of course, at this trial, they convicted the Nazi regime of turning its face against progress and so on and so forth. And and this was in 1934. So already. So this is the way they were doing. And it was a disgrace to allow that to take place in the United States. And the government of the United States should have stopped it. Well, anyway, so Dodd was trying to do something. He supposedly said some things that shed light on his own view of Jews, but I don't see any of that actually being mentioned here. But they see him as some kind of a hidden or subverted National Socialist. I mean, anti-Semite. You know, or not subverted, secret anti-Semite. So he wrote to the judge, who had been invited to take part in this trial, Judge Girard, and asked him to, no, he wrote to somebody else. He wrote to Colonel Edward M. House, that's it. Colonel Edward M. House, the advisor to Woodrow Wilson, was still around, and now he was a senior advisor to President Roosevelt. And so this Dodd wrote to House, who supposedly was a friend of his, and asked him if he couldn't do something to stop this Judge Girard from accepting this invitation to take part in this trial, because it appeared that he was going to do it. And he gave these reasons to House. He said these Jewish demonstrations against the Germans government are creating a race issue here and even winning, he called it Nazi support. They say Nazi support. I don't know. It was causing, people didn't like it. And so they were feeling better. They were supporting the Nazis rather than the Jews. And, he also believed that Hitler had decided to ease up on the Jews. And, of course, you know, the Jews around the world, the international jury, did not want Hitler to ease up on the Jews. They wanted this issue to go as far as it could go, and they managed to turn it into something that went very far indeed. But Dodd said that he had personally assured Hitler that Chicago Jews were not so wild as the ones in New York, which is true, was no doubt true. Nothing like New York Jews. So he urged him to help out with this, and I guess House did do that. And so Judge Girard declined the invitation, and because he wouldn't go and take part in it, the whole thing fell apart, and the one in Chicago never took place. So they consider that in Dodd's letter to House, he said, "I'm almost sure the information was given once more by one of the chosen people." He puts that in little quote marks. So these are things that show the Jews that he was an anti-Semite. You see, if you say even the slightest thing, like using the word the chosen people, shows that, you know, you're being disrespectful to them. Anyway, this article has come out. It's supposed to be new historical evidence and so on. And this Dr. Raphael Medoff is director of the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies in Washington, D.C., and author of 15 books about Jewish history and the Holocaust. The latest is FDR and the Holocaust, A Breach of Faith. But here's just one more of these so-called scholars running one more of these institutes that they have in Washington, D.C., and writing books and so on and promoting their Jewish agenda. It's just amazing how many of them there are. now, well, it looks like I am just about out of time. And I was going to go in a little bit to the euthanasia problem, which I was going to do last week, or I didn't get very far, and I'm not getting very far this time either. But there is something I want to bring up. I'll try to do it in the time I have. There's this article at Salon.com, which I just happened to see because someone sent it, because it's about Germany's racial hygiene program. They call it biological fascism at Salon.com, super liberal place. And the title of it is Charles Davenport was a renowned and influential scientist. He was also a racial purist who inspired the Nazis. Written by Paul Martin. And it's a long article about the United States sterilization program. I guess you call it, racial hygiene program in the United States, that was spurred on and kind of led by this biologist called Charles Davenport, who was a very highly respected man and respected scholar, and how this went on for three decades in the United States. And of course, they just at Salon, they just think it's terrible. It's a shameful chapter in our history and so on. But they use a lot of inflaming language here. But one of the things that was bad about him was that he collaborated with eugenicists in Nazi Germany. I'm just going to say Germany. Leave out the Nazi. He collaborated with eugenicists in Germany, and they were actually learning a lot, from what he said and what he wrote and what he was doing. They thought it was a good idea. At that time, this Charles Davenport was hailed as a trailblazer, and he studied and taught at the most prestigious institutions of higher learning. He was a product of a puritanical upbringing, and he grew up in Connecticut and worked on a farm in the spring and summer months. And the rest of the year he lived in Brooklyn. So, I mean, he was, he got turned on to this. In his studies, he was an instructor at Harvard, and then he went to become went to the University of Chicago as an assistant professor, and then he was offered this job as director of the new Station for Experimental Evolution at Cold Springs Harbor, New York, and that's where he started his genetic research, and it was a genetics research center funded by the Carnegie Institution, which is always blamed for getting into this kind of thing. And they thought that they were going to try to destroy the people they didn't like and increase the number of people they did like, rather than that they might have been sincere about wanting to have a little human direction in the evolution and heredity and eugenics of the human race, so that we'd have a better, more intelligent and more thoughtful and healthier people in our, what they consider to be the Western world was the ruling class of the world. It was, the white race was the ruling race, and there was no question about that at the time. They compiled detailed pedigrees on thousands of families, and what they thought were desirable traits and what were undesirable traits that were passed on from one generation to the next. And they did all this research, and here they believe that good traits were intelligence, honesty, industriousness, and these were predominant in middle and upper class WASPs, and that bad traits, criminality, immorality, shiftlessness, tended to be found in everybody else. That, well, that's the way they put it, but, you know, I don't think they were that bad about it. But there was this Englishman, Francis Galton, who was a cousin of Charles Darwin, and they say that he started this whole thing of eugenics up in 1883. He suggested that society could be improved by encouraging intelligent, successful couples to marry and have children, and to perpetuate the superior qualities. This is called positive eugenics. And the one where you sterilize people and stop people who you don't want to perpetuate is called negative eugenics. And so, you know, positive eugenics is okay. But some people even dislike that now because they say it gives the idea that some people are better than other people. And here again is where you have this. We've come to where you can't say that some people are better than other people, when we can certainly see that if intelligent, successful people marry and have children, that's better than if unsuccessful, low intelligence or even worse people marry and have children, right? If you're talking about your own race, if you're talking about love of your own race, if you want to help destroy your race and make it easier for other races to take over, then you wouldn't want to do that. That tells you where they're coming from. Anyway, all kinds of big names were involved in promoting this, you know, in the U.S., Rockefeller Foundation, Carnegie Institution, John Kellogg, the cereal tycoon, Mary Harriman, the railroad fortune heiress, Teddy Roosevelt, Alexander Graham Bell, all supported the aims of the American eugenics movement. And colleges and universities allowed these courses to be taught. And Charles Davenport wrote a textbook called Heredity in Relation to Eugenics, and that was used in the schools, in the colleges and universities. But then they say that it was all inspired because white Protestant Americans feared being overrun by immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. Well, they, you know, they, there certainly was prejudice against people in, okay, I got my 60-second cue, ladies and gentlemen. So there certainly was prejudice against Catholics. I remember when I was growing up, I experienced it. I wasn't known to be a Catholic, but my family was Catholic, which I knew. And so I heard a lot of anti-Catholic stuff that kind of made me feel uncomfortable. I was really kind of surprised me. Anyway, this is the story of how the eugenics program in America got destroyed and got decided that it was the wrong way to go. And I think it was a sad day when that happened, truthfully. But there's a whole lot more to this article. But I've got to stop now. So, ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for listening to this program today. I'm sorry it wasn't a little bit more put together, but maybe it was okay. So I'll see you on Monday. Good night. Good afternoon.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.